This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother stone. You better learn your past, you better learn young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
Welcome. The title of tonight's installment is The Racial Roots of Europeans, Part 2. This is of a piece with the installment from last week where I want to review a little bit what I covered then. Will help us all remember the details here. And what I'm trying to do is give a sort of Cliff Notes version of the racial roots of Europeans. I've pointed to a textbook by Carlton Kuhn, called The Races of Europe, and quoted a bit from the introduction to that book last time, and I began to read from William Pierce's Who We Are last time, and I'm going to read some more from that this time as well. But just to review on the timeline that we're talking about here, starts at the beginning of the Paleolithic. And actually, let me break it down this way, that we talk first about the Pleistocene era, which is from about 2.5 million years ago to about 12,000 years ago, and then the Holocene era, which is from 12,000 years ago till today, and that's the era we're in now. And the Pleistocene era had several glacial phases interspersed with interglacial. And we are at the moment in an interglacial in the Holocene era. That's a period of relative warming. And both of these, the Pleistocene and Holocene, are actually broken down into finer grain epochs or periods. The period from 2.5 million years ago until about 8,000 BC was called the Paleolithic or Stone Age. And then came the Mesolithic, which separated the Paleolithic from the Neolithic, the Neolithic being from 8,000 BC to about 3,000 BC, followed by the Bronze Age, which was 3,000 BC to 1,000 BC, and the Iron Age from 1,000 BC to now. We talked about the rise of the Neanderthal, starting at about 100,000 years ago, and then the Cro-Magnon, appeared about 30,000 years ago, and the Cro-Magnon replaced the Neanderthal. So let me continue here. I was just about to read about Upper Paleolithic man, and the Upper Paleolithic was the latest period in the Stone Age, the Paleolithic era, from about 40,000 years ago to 8,000 BC. For roughly 20,000 years during the closing chapter of the Ice Ages, the period known to archaeologists as the Upper Paleolithic or Late Old Stone Age, our ancestors lived as big game hunters in Europe, ranging from the Mediterranean coast to the edge of the ice in the north. Their physical remains and those of their artifacts are relatively plentiful, giving us a great deal of information about them and their lifestyle. One of the most striking things about the Upper Paleolithic inhabitants of Europe was their physical homogeneity. Measurements made on their skeletal remains indicate a population more racially homogeneous than that of any European country today, and this population was spread over an enormous area throughout a span of time very long compared to that of all recorded human history. As one would expect, the evidence of their art indicates a corresponding degree of psychic homogeneity. A remarkable similarity exists, for example, in cave paintings found at locations ranging from the Iberian Peninsula all the way to the Urals, a distance of more than 3,000 miles. Upper Paleolithic whites, and let me just say here that I'm not reading a single section from Who We Are. I tried to cut and paste together this Cliff Notes version, which I didn't write any of this, but I did at least try to snip out pieces that I thought gave a good summary, a good overview of things. But I left out quite a bit, and I'm not going to mention from here on where I'm skipping and cutting out bits and pieces. Upper Paleolithic whites had broad, rugged faces with large, wide jaws, prominent chins, and judging from the nasal openings in their skulls, prominent noses of narrow to medium width, and they had large brains, nearly 100 cubic centimeters larger than the white average today. They were predominantly dolichocephalic. Let me try that again. Dolichocephalic, long-headed, like modern Nordics and Mediterraneans. Although this was one physical trait in which the Upper Paleolithic population showed substantial diversity, with a larger minority of mesocephalitic and brachiocephalitic, round-headed like modern alpines, skulls in the west than in the east. Throughout the Upper Paleolithic, this white proto-race lived not only in Europe, but also in a band stretching across northern Asia to the Pacific. In Siberia and other eastern regions, they were eventually displaced or absorbed by Mongoloid peoples, although isolated pockets of them have survived even until the present. In Europe, when the Ice Ages came to an end, some of the white big game hunters changed their way of life, and some did not, but instead followed the retreating glaciers northward as they shrank back toward their nucleus in the mountains of the Scandinavian peninsula. Neither the Nordics nor the Alpines of today are physically identical to the Upper Paleolithic whites, although both are ultimately related to them. In both the Nordic and the Alpine areas of Europe, however, one finds local populations which are essentially Upper Paleolithic in type. From their artifacts, we can gain a good idea of how they lived. Most of these artifacts are tools or weapons made of bone or stone, but there are also carved art objects, paintings, hearths, and remnants of dwellings. They made a great variety of stone implements, prominent among which were long thin blades struck from carefully prepared stone cores with a single precise blow. Such stone blades were not entirely unknown during the preceding Neanderthal stage of human development. But now they became much more common, and the tool-making technology associated with them took several strides forward. Another distinguishing feature of Upper Paleolithic European culture was the extensive use of bone. It was carved into sewing needles, clothing, fastenings, and ornaments, statuettes, harpoon and spearheads, musical instruments, and many other items, using stone tools manufactured especially for the purpose. The Upper Paleolithic economy was based on herd animals, horses, woolly mammoths, bison, and especially reindeer. These animals flourished on the tundra, and the people of Europe depended almost totally on them. From their flesh came food, from their hides, clothing and covering for shelters, and from their bones, tools and implements. This was, just to make to inject a point here of my own, this was hunter-gatherers, and that's why they were so dependent upon these herd animals that they hunted. Permanent villages. Some groups of hunters apparently followed the herds on their seasonal migrations, but others established year-round settlements. Typically, these settlements were occupied by from 5 to 20 families, which was from 20 to 100 individuals. And the habitations varied from single-family huts, probably covered with animal skins, to long multi-family houses with gable roofs. One such Ice Age longhouse in southern Russia was nearly 450 feet long. Despite the harsh environment, the tundra supported large herds, and the hunters apparently had plenty to eat. They obviously had the leisure time and the inclination to devote themselves to non-essential pastimes, such as art and music. And we see these things, by the way, in European man today, this love of hunting, and hunting has become a pastime, as well as art and music. These are European characteristics. Birth of ceramics. These Ice Age Europeans were inventive people. In a few thousand years, they introduced more cultural innovations than in all of mankind's previous existence. They learned, for example, to use coal as a fuel, and they learned that by firing statuettes and other objects molded of clay, they obtained a much more durable, water-resistant product. Fired clay objects recently found at Dolny Vistonice in Moravia, and dated at 28,000 years ago, represent man's first use of the ceramic techniques which played such an important role in his later cultural development. Until quite recently, archaeologists had assumed that the ceramic technology was first developed by farming peoples in the Middle East almost 20,000 years later. There is also evidence that the Ice Age hunters carried on trade over distances of hundreds of miles, at least. Ice Age archers. Two enormously significant inventions which date from the closing phase of the Verm Ice Age, and just to inject here, the Verm Ice Age was from about 110,000 years ago to about 10,000 years ago. So just as a probably not quite a coincidence, the Neanderthal, the earliest samples of the Neanderthal have been found at 100,000 years ago. So the fact that the Verm Ice Age started 110,000 years ago may be significant. There may help you remember, too, these periods of time and how they're related to each other. Two enormously significant inventions dating from the closing phase of the Verm Ice Age are the spear thrower and the bow. Approximately 15,000 years ago, Upper Paleolithic whites learned to throw a hunting spear with much greater force by using the leverage provided by a piece of carved reindeer antler hooked over the butt. This invention gradually spread over the world, and the racially backward Australian Aborigines still use spear throwers for hunting today. Some 11,000 years ago, our European ancestors invented the world's second propulsive weapon, the bow. Although the earliest bow, which has been found at Holmgard, Denmark, is only about 8,000 years old, collections of arrows 3,000 years older with clearly identifiable notches for a bowstring have been unearthed at Stelmore near Hamburg. The bow gave man an incalculable advantage in hunting, as he no longer had to creep up on his prey to within spear range. Two gaps in Upper Paleolithic man's cultural achievements are primarily responsible for the limitations in our knowledge of him and his ways. He did not write, and he seldom portrayed human beings in his prolific art. Our first kinsman. It is clear that the race which hunted reindeer on the tundra of northern Europe from the second Verm glacial advance until about 10,000 years ago was essentially modern, not only physically but also psychically, and was therefore the first race to appear on this earth with whom we can feel the bond of full kinship. And this is what I really wanted to get to here, was this this group of people that first settled Europe before the Aryans, and the ones that, according to Pierce here and who we are the first that we can really feel some bond, full kinship with. Until now, we have traced the development of a single racial, rather homogenous racial group, the whites of the Upper Paleolithic period who hunted the herds on the northern Eurasian plain, and their forest and coast-dwelling descendants in the Mesolithic period. Remember, the Mesolithic is the period between the Upper Paleolithic and the coming Neolithic period. And what's significant about the Neolithic period is that that's when farming was introduced. Throughout the whole Upper Paleolithic period, there was another subracial type on the southern and southeastern margins of Europe, averaging about 5 inches shorter than the Upper Paleolithic whites, with slenderer build, smaller heads, narrower faces, and more delicate features. The male and female members of this southern subrace were quite similar in skeletal appearance. That is, they were a pedomorphic subrace. Now, pedomorphic means retention of retaining juvenile characteristics in the adult. So they look more childlike, even as adults. That's what pedomorphic means. To use the ethnological term, the adults did not develop as strong a degree of sexual differentiation as did the Upper Paleolithic whites. these were the ancestors of today's small, dark, narrow-faced pedomorphic Mediterraneans. Some 150,000 years ago, during the relatively mild Ris-Firm interglacial period, the ancestors of the Upper Paleolithic whites first expanded from southern Europe into the northern Eurasian plain. But some of their fellows remained behind, along both the northern and southern shores of the Mediterranean and in the Middle East. Those who went north and became big game hunters went through the Neanderthaloid phase and eventually evolved into the Cro-Magnon type of the Upper Paleolithic. Those who remained in the south evolved under different conditions, becoming the Mediterranean type. And this is along the lines of what Carlton Kuhn's thesis was, that there, what he was talking about was when he, what he referred to as the white race was really what we would call the Caucasian race, and he focused on this group, this Mediterranean group, as being sort of the ancestors from which, or a pool and a homeland from which the part, some of them went up into Europe following the ice as it receded, and some also moved into Asia and eventually became the Aryans. Continuing here with Pierce's piece, the Cro-Magnon subrace, which was the principal racial element in Europe during the Upper Paleolithic and Mesolithic periods, i.e. from about 40,000 years ago until the introduction of farming 6,000 to 8,000 years ago, is represented today by groups of Upper Paleolithic survivors in Ireland, northern Germany, Scandinavia, and other parts of northern Europe. The Cro-Magnon homeland may be considered to be the vast northern European plain, stretching from the Alps in the south to the North Sea and the Baltic Sea in the north, and from Ireland in the west to the Urals in the east. And we can see that Doggerland, probably, just to inject here a bit, probably played a role in this, in the contiguity of that region, that it was all one connected landmass when the ice had captured so much water and the seas were very low. The Alpine subrace has been derived from the Cro-Magnon subrace through a complex of genetic changes involving a reduction in stature, a decrease in relative head length, a slight decrease in sexual differentiation, and perhaps some Mediterranean admixture. The Alpine homeland is the mountain belt stretching across Western and Central Europe, i.e. it is in that region that Alpines have historically constituted the largest portion of the population. And the various Mediterranean types, whose ancestors developed more or less separately from the Cro-Magnon subrace, have their homelands along the African and European shores of the Mediterranean Sea and in the Middle East. Population explosion. When men everywhere lived by hunting, fishing, and gathering natural vegetation, population densities were everywhere quite small, on the order of one person for every 5 square miles of habitable land. When they began living by farming and raising livestock, however, population densities rapidly increased more than 100-fold. It was in the Mediterranean racial area, on Europe's borders, rather than in its interior, that the Neolithic Revolution began. And thus, beginning about 9,000 years ago, the Mediterraneans gained a strong numerical advantage over the Cro-Magnons and their Alpine relatives. Several groups of Mediterraneans, representing several varieties, were able to push northward and westward into Europe, initially swamping the sparse hunter-gatherer population. Even though the Cro-Magnons themselves experienced a population surge when they became farmers, the initial advantage of the Mediterraneans resulted in a lasting Mediterranean numerical dominance in many areas that had formerly been Cro-Magnon. Most areas of Mediterranean penetration became racially mixed, with the ratio of Cro-Magnon to Mediterranean blood varying from place to place. But the Mediterraneans were not the only ones to invade the Cro-Magnon areas of Europe during the Neolithic period. From the steppes of southern Russia, in the region between the Black Sea and the Caspian, came wave after wave of a subrace which differed from all the others which we have encountered thus far. Not quite as ruggedly built as the Cro-Magnons, yet more so than the Mediterraneans, they were tall and fair. They may have learned the arts of agriculture from earlier contact with a nearby Mediterranean group, or they may have developed farming on their own. But whichever the case, they were already carrying these arts westward and northwestward with them nearly 6,000 years ago. Superb craftsmen as well as farmers and cattle breeders, they were, above all else, warriors. Wherever they went, they conquered and ruled. These are the Aryans that Vincent described so well, I think, in that first part of Who's White. And their culture ruled also. Their language replaced the language of the conquered peoples everywhere, as did their religion, their art, and their social customs. These were the Nordics. I'll read a little bit here about, skipping quite a bit, about the old European civilization lasted about 3,000 years, until about 5,000 years ago. Just to make something clear here that I hadn't before, I sort of think of everything from 2.5 million years ago as old Europe, and maybe from the beginning of the Neanderthals, 100,000 years ago, or even you could say from the upper Paleolithic, that's old Europe. But when people refer to old Europe, when you look it up in Wikipedia or when paleontologists talk about it, what they're talking about is this actual civilization, the rise of settled areas and agriculture, which lasted about 3,000 years with the incursion of Mediterranean people in another wave, a discernible wave, into Europe. And it lasted until about 5,500 years ago. Then it disintegrated utterly. Its temples and gods, its towns, its language, all disappeared in an overwhelming disaster, the arrival of Bronze Age Nordic warriors from the east. The creators of the old European civilization were a blend of Mesolithic Cro-Magnons, originally in the Balkan area, and the Neolithic Mediterraneans who infiltrated the area, beginning a little over 8,500 years ago. Most of these Mediterraneans were of a variety anthropologists called Danubian, and they were short, graceful, and pedomorphic. Because the Cro-Magnon population differed physically in so many respects from the Danubians, there were substantial geographic variations in racial type in old Europe, depending upon the proportions of the two basic stocks present in the blend. When the Nordics arrived, the geographical racial pattern became even more varied. The racial homogeneity, which had existed in most of Europe during the Upper Paleolithic period, was gone for good. Let me read a section from Wikipedia about Neolithic Europe, or which is a synonym for Old Europe, about the basic cultural characteristics. Regardless of the specific chronology, many European Neolithic groups share basic characteristics such as living in small-scale, presumably egalitarian, family-based communities, subsisting on domesticated plants and animals, supplemented with the collection of wild plant foods and with hunting, and producing handmade pottery, that is, pottery made without the potter's wheel. There are also many differences, with some Neolithic communities in southern Europe living in heavily fortified settlements of 3,000 to 4,000 people, whereas Neolithic groups in England were small, possibly 5 to 100 people, and highly mobile cattle herders. The details of the origin, chronology, social organization, subsistence practices, and ideologies of these peoples of Neolithic Europe are obtained from archaeology and not historical records, since these people left none. Since the 1970s, population genetics has provided independent data on the population history of Neolithic Europe, including migration events and genetic relationships with peoples in South Asia. A further independent tool, linguistics, has contributed hypothetical reconstructions of the early European languages and family trees, with estimates of dating and of splits, in particular theories on the relationship between speakers of Indo-European languages and Neolithic peoples. This is I wanted to read that section because this is a theme that I've been weaving in several of these installments here, starting with the first one, is that the evidence behind all of this is not mythology. This narrative that I've been laying out here for the last half dozen or so installments is, there's evidence for it in the linguistics, there's evidence for it in cultural artifacts and archaeology, and there's evidence in the DNA. And we're going to talk about the DNA, I think, in the next couple of installments. I'll give a review of that evidence and its importance to race. Let me describe here read a bit more from Pierce's Who We Are, contrasting the old Europeans and the the Aryans or the Nordics. The religion of the people of old Europe, like the religion of every race, was created in their own image, a spiritual reflection of their inner nature. They were farmers, Mediterranean, and passive. They were a settled race, and their ties were with the soil. Although we can decipher none of their religious inscriptions, it seems safe to assume that, like other soil-bound people, their religion was centered on the concept of fertility. Certainly, this is suggested by the abundance of female figurines, stylized vulva symbols, and other evidences of a flourishing fertility cult, which have been unearthed by archaeologists along with other remnants of the old European culture. The abundance of the life-giving soil, the seasonal death and rebirth of the green earth, the mating and the birthing of their domestic animals, these were essential mysteries, and it was around these that the religious concepts of the matriarchal society must have been formed. Theirs was the religion of the Earth Mother. In contrast, the battle axe people, the blonde horsemen from the east, the conquerors of old Europe, were a race on the move. Nordic, active, patriarchal, dominating, they too farmed and bred livestock, but they were far less soil-bound in their outlook than the Mediterranean's. Warriors, explorers, rulers, they were less concerned with the mysteries of plant and animal reproduction and more concerned with valor, honor, and authority. Their spiritual focus was upward and outward, toward the sky and far horizons, rather than downward toward the soil and inward toward their own bodily functions, as in the case of the Mediterranean's. Theirs was the religion of the Sky Father. And I think this is why so much emphasis is put on the Aryans, because the Aryans are considered far more noble and conquering and strong than the old Europeans were, that whom they conquered. This is why the National Socialists probably focused more on the Aryans. And this is why white racialists in general, I think, focus more on the Aryans. But in my exploration of this, these racial roots, I didn't want to neglect any of the racial roots, and that's why it's important even to recognize that these Mediterranean peoples also have their feet and their genes in Europe as well. I read a bit from the introduction to Who We Are the last time in conclusion, and I'd like to do that again here because I got cut off. There were three paragraphs to read, and I only got to read the first two. The first two concerned identity and how important it is, and you know why this knowledge of our history is important to our identity. And the last paragraph concerns what happens when people's knowledge and pride are lacking. A community is subject to a host of ills and cannot long endure. Solidarity and a sense of responsibility to the community give place to special interest, factionalism, and alienation. A lack of a sense of identity blurs the distinction between compatriot and stranger, between friend and foe, and leaves the community prey to the greed or malice of aliens, as well as its own pathological members, who will grow mightily in numbers as loss of identity proceeds. And I think that that very well describes why it's important that we all are aware of this history, at the very least, the Cliff Notes version of it. And if you're interested more, you can check the webpage for this installment and all the previous installments. And I hope you will go to the links that I provide and read in more detail the information there. See you next time.